Welcome to History's Hotties, the podcast that discusses the sometimes forgotten but influential women in American history, and I am your host, Krista. Today we are on episode 13, and our title today is The Veterans at Home, a tribute to the military wife. I know that this podcast is very late, and I apologize. I think it's probably been 4 or 5 weeks since I've published a podcast, and I apologize to our listeners. It has been really busy, but excitingly enough, my husband actually came back from Korea for a few days to visit, so very, very glad about that, and he is kindly hiding in the back of the house while I record right now, and my teenager that is still at home is in her room doing her homework, so hopefully I can have some quiet for a few minutes to record. As I started this week's episode, I had a plan, but as I began my research, I was led in a completely different direction. My intention was to finish up our series on the myth of Scarlet by talking about the irony of the womanly ideal and women in slavery. But then, as we celebrated Veterans Day, see, I told you it's been a while since I published a podcast, I thought I might discuss some of the forgotten veterans in our history, the wives left home during war. Now, I know that women have fought in almost every war in this country, including women who lived as camp followers or traveled alongside the soldiers to care for their husbands, sons, and brothers, but until recently in our history, this was not, of course, the norm. So I will refer to wives instead of spouses, which is the politically correct term today, but normally it was wives that we were talking about. My intention was to focus on our first veteran wives of the Revolutionary War. However, after beginning my research again, a wrench was thrown into my plan. My oldest daughter brought me a book called Love and War, A Southern Soldier's Struggle Between Love and Duty, that had a beautiful story and that was too rich not to share. So I'm going to be reading some excerpts from that as well. If you listened to the last episode, we talked a bit about the women of the South who simply wanted their men to come home and abandon the cause, and the lengths the men were willing to go to in an attempt to feed their families. And this book, Love and War, actually contains letters from one of those soldiers. As a history student, I was never really interested in tactics and battles. I was far interested in who won and life at home during the battle. And of course, those left at home were most often women and children. So this week we will cover a bit from both time periods, the Revolutionary War and the Civil War. As many of you who have listened before know, my husband is in the Air Force and has been in Korea for the year. And he has actually been deployed to several different locations in the past. However, I do not even begin to compare my life to those women of the who've lived through historical wars in this country. Even spouses of Gulf War veterans will tell you that it is a different world today than then. Reliable email, weekly phone calls, and widely available APO shipping were sometimes not the norm in certain deployed locations, even during the Gulf War. And certainly not before that. And some spouses deal with their military member being in a location where, you know, those aren't even available now. But for the most part, these things have revolutionized our lives. Of course, having a war on your own soil makes sacrifice a necessity. But even during World War II, the nation went through a draft that left many communities bereft of young men and their contributions, and rationing made other citizens find creative ways to make do with less. So I thought I owed it to my sisters of earlier years to dedicate this podcast to them, and today you are the History's Hotties. But first, a week ago, a couple of friends posted an article from Parenting Guru that I thought I would share because it is so true. It is called 10 Things You May Not Know About Military Wives. Number one, when a deployment is imminent, we just want it to start. That doesn't mean we want our spouses to leave, we don't. But when the date has been set and our husband's bag is sitting half-packed in the corner of the bedroom, we start getting anxious, worried, and a little bit angry. We think about the upcoming months and everything he is going to miss and everything we're going to have to do alone. It's overwhelming. Once they leave, we can start to tackle the challenges one at a time, and that's so much easier than the waiting. But those last few weeks before he leaves are wrought with frustration, nervousness, and a little fear. Number two, we are not miserable the whole time they are gone. We don't like that our family is split up, but we can't live in the future or press a pause button on our lives, so we focus on other things. Hobbies, children, visiting, friends and family, work, our life is still full, just not complete. Number three, but there are tears right underneath the surface. Whenever our children do something new or something exciting or sad happens, or even when there have been just too many nights that we've stayed in alone, we get really sad, and we can't always be sad because we don't want to upset the kids. Number four, that being said, most of us like our lifestyle. We enjoy the adventure of moving every few years, starting over, making new friends, and living in various parts of the country and world. We have close friends everywhere. It's stressful, yes, but also exciting. Number five, we rely on our friends a lot. Even when our husbands are home, we are used to being canceled on at the last minute, not knowing schedules until an hour before an event, or having a job take precedence over the family. So we have friends who are reliable, patient, flexible, and who make us laugh. We love and truly appreciate our friends. So do the kids. Number six, our children are well-adjusted and okay. In fact, most of the time, they are amazing in their ability to see the silver lining in every challenge. From the beginning of their lives, they've moved around, started over, and had apparent leave for huge amounts of time. We have lots of strategies to help them stay connected, and we analyze how to make each deployment as painless as possible on the children. Number seven, we don't need or want pity. We look for love, friendship, and fun. We don't need you to say I'm sorry when we tell you our husbands are away. We knew what we signed up for when we got married. However, we'd be so grateful for a helping hand. Helping us with something that would normally take two people, like shoveling snow or even bringing in our grill for the winter, would be awesome and will relieve the stress a little. Number eight, please don't ask us what we are going to do to, quote-unquote, keep busy when our husbands are gone. Just like you have a healthy relationship with things outside your marriage, so do we. We don't need to keep ourselves entertained or find something to do to pass the time while he's gone. These comments are insulting. We will just continue to live our life. Yes, there will be a hole in it. We will not be pining away for 6 months or a year. So don't try to give us projects or find stuff to keep us busy. We'll be fine. I have to step away from the article a minute here to say, really, you don't need anything else to help keep you busy. Generally, you're pretty doggone busy but from the fact that you're doing things by yourself. So, yeah, projects aren't necessary. So, back to the article. Number nine, there are romantic moments about military life that rival only the most dramatic movies. We've been spun around by a man in uniform after he hasn't seen us in months. We've seen our children run toward their daddy with pure glee and excitement. We've dressed up like royalty and attended military galas, and we've watched ships pull into port with sailors standing at attention around the perimeter. Number 10. And sometimes the civilian population can be so supportive and sweet that it just brings tears to our eyes. These moments are precious and get us through all the tough stuff, so thank you. We appreciate all the thoughts, good wishes, and the extra stuff you do to make us feel better. We notice it, we see it, and it really does help. So, this is by a lady named Sarah Lynn, who is an author for Parenting Guru, and she has been married to a United States sailor for 3 years and for three deployments. So, I just thought I would share. I thought it was a wonderful article, and I thought it was fitting for today. So, a very late Happy Veterans Day to all of you military wives out there. So, back to the podcast. Now we go back to the wives of the Revolutionary War, which happened between the years of 1775 and 1783. Wives in the colonies have been through conflicts like the French and Indian War, but since this podcast is about women of the United States, it makes sense to begin when our country began. It was very important to the men of the 18th century that their wives and daughters protested the British in appropriate female ways. We all know about the spinning bees in the north and southern women who wore homespun cloth instead of cloth imported from Britain, even to fancy balls. And most people have also read about tea boycotts and many women who joined in. The real difference between women of that era and the military wives of today is that most women of the nation were affected in some way by the conflict. Today, so much of our population may know someone who is in the military or who has been deployed to a forward location, but how many people have really had to stop shopping at the Gap or give up their favorite sports drink? But as much as men had this patriotic ideal, the reality was that these women were going to have to take over businesses and farms and live among the soldiers that wish their husbands dead. There were women in the Revolutionary War era who were raped and whipped by the Brits, and loyalists and many women had their property taken and destroyed. So you have both sides. Both sides face danger, both sides face challenges, the loyalist wives and the rebel wives. Eliza Pinckney actually wrote to a friend that much of her property was burned by the occupying army. Abigail Adams, who is certainly not a lesser-known woman in American history, but a woman who left us a great deal of primary source work, turned her home into a hospital and helped house Patriot soldiers. The groups of Haitian soldiers that quartered with some women would burn the fence rails and fight with each other, causing all sorts of problems for the women who were doing their best to run farms and feed their children. Women got together and boycotted stores, which caused some of the Brits to depict them as bad mothers, harlots, and heavy drinkers in their newspapers. But one siege of the store of Thomas Boylston really caught the interest of the men in town when the women literally accosted him and threw him into the back of the cart because he was price gouging for coffee, since the good women of Boston were boycotting tea for the most part. Some women, like Molly Pitcher, and I'm using quote fingers because we don't really know who she was, did begin reloading cannons when their husbands were wounded in battle. Molly Pitcher was probably a woman named Molly Ludwig Hayes, who was a camp follower, but we really can't be totally sure who it actually was. We just know she existed. But for the most part, the colonial goodwife kept the home fires burning very adeptly while her husband was at war. So while these women were sacrificing immensely, they also knew they would never be citizens. So she had to defend herself from unscrupulous shopkeepers and soldiers who were willing to steal from women and children. And that made the fact that women were expected to have soft feminine values even more ironic to women today, I have to say. But first, while this is not a funny subject, I have to share a funny fact that Gail Collins wrote about in her book American Women, 400 Years of Dolls, Drudges, Helpmates, and Heroines. While these women were not bathing very often and spinning cloth, washing clothes in the boiling water and soft soap she made to wash the clothes, churning butter, and I am not making this up, allowing the dog to lick the baby clean, the question of sanitary napkins inevitably comes up. Now, when you read letters and journals from this time period, there were those who used euphemisms to discuss sensitive topics, and there were those who were quite blunt, but one subject that was never discussed was menstruation. In Northampton, one fine afternoon, a man named Oliver Warner stopped a girl named Hannah Clark and her friend on the street and said, "When will the moons change? I believe you have circles round your eyes. I believe it runs." Now, first, ew. Secondly, we do not know why this Oliver character needed to discuss Hannah and her friend's monthly cycles. Gail doesn't tell us what happened, but if that was this guy's way of flirting, I would say he needs to get a new opening line. Now, we know that many women had lots of pregnancies, so they would not have had as many years of menstrual cycles as women today, but there is little evidence about how they dealt with the problem. They probably used cloth from the rag bags that just about every home had for repairing clothing and small sewing jobs. But the main reason we have no idea is that this subject was almost never discussed in polite society. The really funny part about this is that a minister from the period named Jonathan Edwards, really, blamed young men like Oliver making inappropriate comments on reading midwifery books, which he thought opened the imagination of young men to subjects they had no business thinking about. Sort of funny to think of a John Edwards as the moral authority. I had to laugh. Sometimes a namesake can truly fail to live up to a previous model. So I know that had nothing to do with women living through the Revolutionary War, but it was just a funny story that I had to share. So back to the women during the Revolutionary War. This letter to Paul Revere from his wife encompasses how these women felt and acted during the war. Rachel Revere was running the farm and attempted to help her husband in any way she could. Unfortunately, it didn't turn out as she had hoped. On April 18th, 1775, Paul Revere made his famous midnight ride to Lexington, Massachusetts, warning his countrymen of the British troops' planned attack. Revere was captured later that night, but his actions marshaled colonial troops to the famous first battle on Lexington Green, where the American Revolution began the next day. When he was released, Revere started back towards Boston, despite having neither money nor horse. With this note, his worried wife, Rachel Walker Revere, tried to send help. Dr. Benjamin Church was trusted by Rachel as a fellow rebel, but was in fact a British spy, so Rachel's letter was promptly turned over to the British when she gave it to, gave this to Dr. Church. So, this is a letter from Rachel Revere to Paul Revere. "My dear, by Dr. Church, I send £125 and beg you will take the best care of yourself and not attempt coming into this town again, and if I have an opportunity of coming or sending out anything or any of the children, I shall do it. Pray keep up your spirits and trust yourself and us in this hands of God, of a good God, who will take care of us. 'Tis all my dependence, for vain is the help of a man. Adieu, my love, from your affectionate R. Revere." Women like Rachel and Esther DeBert Reed, who wrote in Sentiments of an American Woman that these women were willing to dress more simply, do without personally, so their new nation could conquer and prosper, even while facing danger, were amazing women in immense danger. I mean, you just, I can't even imagine that today. You know, I don't have to send my husband money or send secret notes to him, hoping that the person I give it to isn't a spy to keep him safe. He has an entire infrastructure around him to keep him safe. So I couldn't even imagine living like this. Anyway, I thought that was a sweet letter, and I thought you all would like to hear, even though it didn't turn out quite so well. Apparently, she picked a bad messenger. So the revolution is over, and time has passed, and the Civil War has taken over a new generation's peace and tranquility. And again, instead of a few citizens sacrificing for the good of the war, the entire nation is overtaken in the fighting. Now, in the North, life did somewhat still continue. In fact, things like women's medical colleges emerged right before and during the war, which was partly in response to the need for females in the medical profession. Though female doctors were certainly not the answer to the shortage of doctors in most people's opinions. The point here is that the whole North was not consumed by fighting like the South was, but they did sacrifice. Women did bust out of their traditional roles for a while, but it was out of plain necessity from the war, not because the basic structure of society was being challenged by idealistic reformers. Now, we have discussed the changes made by working-class women of the South during the Civil War, and again, we will discuss slave women in a podcast all their own later. But during the war, in the homes of the North and South, wives of soldiers made all kinds of sacrifices for the cause. Now, I understand that Southern wives were not technically part of the United States during this period, but really, they are all women of America, so I decided to include them, well, because I can, and because I think that we have to look at the rebel territory while they were rebels, or we lose a large chunk of our history, and that really that history makes the nation that we have today. However, first, we will discuss the North. In the North, the women at home, those with husbands in the army, and those who did not, all formed a sanitary commission to help supply the Union troops with things like shirts, gloves, drawers — that would be underwear for you guys who have never heard, have never had your undies referred to as drawers — and hospital supplies, as well as cash. Women went door to door raising money for the Union Army, and patriotism reigned. Some women became nurses, who earned 40 cents a day, by the way, while the Southern nurses earned 40 Confederate dollars, if that tells you a little bit about inflation in the South. And lots of Northern women went to the factories, but they were treated terribly by the factory owners. So many women who would normally have stayed at home during the day began to work outside of the home for the first time. There were, however, many women who took on piecework so they could stay at home with their children, since they were on their own. And they were often treated even worse than the factory workers by the subcontractors that worked for the government and passed out the piecework. So while Southern women were asking their husbands to go AWOL so they could plant crops for the season, Northern women were petitioning Congress to do something about unscrupulous subcontractors and a draft that targeted the working poor. If any of you have seen Gangs of New York, you have gotten a taste of how the draft riots of New York worked. But for those of you who haven't, this is an event that reflects why working-class women of the North sacrificed a great deal for their cause. According to the draft law of 1863, all white men from 20 to 45 were required to do military service, but people who were able to pay $300, and some families had put every penny they had into paying this fee, were able to avoid conscription for their husbands, brothers, or sons. The riots began in poor Irish neighborhoods, and wealthy people as well as poor blacks became targets for the violence. 1,200 people were killed, and lots of people, including women, were arrested and jailed. By the way, poor blacks became targets because the working-class immigrants that were unable to pay the conscription relief, or the conscription fee, often competed with these free blacks for the same jobs, yet they were being drafted into an army that was fighting to free slaves, which the other immigrants saw as a challenge to their ability to feed their families. One of the major problems was that the New York State Militia had been sent to help the Union Army in Pennsylvania at this time, so the defense of the streets lied solely in the hands of the police, but the police were not outfitted to fight against a group of aggressors the size of a small army. So when the rioters started and they went into these neighborhoods and they started, you know, injuring and killing people, the police really were not able to get it under control for several days. And they tried to petition the city and the state, of course, the state to repeal the draft law. And there was some real, infighting and some resistance from the state before things finally changed. They made some concessions. Anyway, like the working class women of the South, Northern women relied on their entire family, and especially their husbands, to help supply the basic necessities of life. And while Northern soldiers were paid a salary, and a part of the salary could be sent home, just the sheer fact that the men were gone was a real challenge to these families, who did not want to sacrifice their men, not only to a possible war wound, but also to disease, hypothermia, or possible capture for a war that didn't benefit them. However, because the majority of the fighting was on Southern soil, most of these women did not suffer the threat of men actually invading their home to pillage. So the day-to-day may not have, that was probably a little more similar to our military spouses of today, except, of course, for the fact that people were sacrificing their incidentals for the cause. Magazines like the Goodies Ladies Book ran stories about how women should be careful not to become too political, but helped the cause in a feminine way, and encouraged volunteerism where they had been running stories about how to not to ruin your children and how to arrange your home previously. So every part of society, even in the North, where there weren't soldiers outside on the streets, they were still just encompassing the war in all of their daily lives. There were women who went to places like Gettysburg to nurse wounded troops, but the town of Gettysburg, as described by Cornelia Hancock, a Union nurse, really did face the same fate after the battle that many Southern women described of their own towns and cities after the passage of the Union Army. Cornelia said that most citizens were stripped of everything they have, as you can imagine citizens living in a war zone might be, and they were left to care for the wounded soldiers. These nurses worked for days at a time in terrible conditions, running from wounded soldiers to groups of wounded soldiers and then other groups of wounded soldiers, watching death all around them, which is ironic when you refer back to the cult of domesticity. It again shows the irony of the ideal versus the reality when real life overtakes the ideal. During a war, you really can't be concerned about, you know, how things appear. The other story here is that through the writings of some women, you can see the deep divide of these women and their lives through the descriptions of the other side. Mary Beth Norton highlights the letters of a nurse who describes having to care for soldiers from the other side. Ada Baycott, a Confederate nurse, feared that she would not give the same care to the Yankee soldiers and was surprised to see that the soldiers are grateful for the care she gives them. But she doesn't want to know their names. She doesn't want to really have any discussion with them. She doesn't want to have sympathy. A Northern woman, Caroline Kirkland, says that Southern women weren't really sacrificing if they lived very simply in the first place, and that these women were either being forced into hardship by their husbands or were supporting slavery and did not deserve sympathy because their cause was not worthy. Kirkland also says that no industry had been interrupted in the North, and that in her opinion, there have been few sacrifices in the actual homes of the North. Now, while I am sure this is not completely true because of the massive work done in supplies and money collected by the Sanitary Commission, this does show that in reality, the day-to-day life of the woman in 1863 New York City did not change like the day-to-day life of the farm wife in the 1863 Georgia countryside. Morning calls may have been replaced by sewing bees and church meetings now full of rolling bandages, but the fight to feed the family and keep a farm running was not the norm. So, in the South, as we have discussed before, the working class wife generally ran the farm as best she could while fending off fighting, theft from troops who might come through, and sometimes feared the slaves who were left to help her run the farm. Many women fled west, often taking the entire household with them, and there were women who feared retribution from the slaves their husbands or overseers had been cruel to in the past. There were massive shortages of items such as shoes, food, paper, boots, cooking utensils, sawed wood, nails, and just about every other item you can imagine that would need to be manufactured, which the South had previously shipped in from the North. Industrialization proved to be a real problem. The items now used in daily life became really difficult to find. Hoop skirts became impossible because of the scarcity of the cloth, and even women that could afford items they wanted could not always find them. I love the quote from one woman who said, quote, "Nothing looks funnier than a woman walking around with an immense hoop barefooted," unquote. That would look pretty silly, but some women really felt the need to try to remain as normal as possible, even in the most challenging of times. The planter class women, by the way, did raise money as well, in a little different way than the Sanitary Commission in the North. In fact, I was looking through a book here at our local landmark society at the quilts that some women made to sell and raise money for the cause at auction, was the quote. I know that I haven't said where we live, but I have said that we are Air Force, so we move around quite a bit. And certainly you can tell from my accent that I am from the South, and we are actually living in the South right now for at least a few more months. So it's a really interesting landmark society we have here and the things that I've seen. We have discussed women taking over running plantations and smaller farms, and the women who moved to Texas often did the same, trying to make income for the family in the absence of their husbands. But after a while, this day-to-day life began to drain them. And in 1864, a story ran in the Montgomery Daily Advertiser that disparaged the war-weary women. The newspaper said, quote, "The self-sacrifice has vanished. Wives and maidens now labor only to exempt husbands and lovers from the perils of service," end quote. And there are always the stories of the women that dressed as men to enlist in addition to becoming spies. Now, because the fighting for the South was often near their home territory, which does explain why so many men were able to go AWOL so easily, the families did often show up after a battle to help their loved ones. And there were female nurses, but a lot of times locals would come out, like the locals up in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, did, to care for the wounded. So there are some similarities we see. But regardless of the side, the war, or the nation, the real story behind the military wife is the fact that she is without the man she loves. She may have married a soldier or married a man who later became a soldier, but in any case, every struggle just reminds her of how much her life has changed for a cause that may or may not benefit her, but it is the duty of her husband to defend. So in Love and War by Robert H. Crewdson, he tells the story of Meredith Merritt Branch Thurman and Jane Rosser Humphrey, who married in 1862. Crewdson has the letters from Merritt to Jane, but the ones from Jane to Merritt were destroyed, so we only get to see his side. Merritt was a boatman who had also worked in the Clover Mill mines in Virginia, but probably met Jane, who was a teenager at the time, while operating a boat near her home in Buck Island. And what follows are some of the most beautiful love letters I have ever read. This simple man poured out his heart to Jane in a way that every wife would love to hear. So I will read the letters as written, and of course, the spelling is spotty at best, and the punctuation is non-existent, so forgive my diction. I'm just going to read a couple of the letters, of course. I'm not going to read all of them because that would take forever, but I thought you'd like to hear a couple of them. December the 6th, 1862. 60. Miss Jane Ross, I embrace the present opportunity of writing a few lines to you to inform you that I have not forgotten about you. Yet I will be up and about the 10th of the month. My ink is bad. My pen is keen. I love you better than all the girls I have ever seen. I rather see you than anyone in the world. Of you every hour in the day. Nothing more at present. Yours sincerely, M. B. Thurman, your affectionate friend. I love that. So that's how he began courting her. I would say that's pretty sly and definitely better than that Oliver character who asked the girl if she was having her period, which was just, you know, gross. Anyway, then, as was common, and I love this, in that era, a man named A.W. Trabue wrote a letter testifying to Merritt's character, and from there the romance really blossomed, at least from Merritt's end. But it must have been a two-way thing, because the letters indicate that Jane was answering him and sending him things he needed at the front, and a couple of different times went AWOL to see her, willing to risk being in the brig when he returned so that he could see her. So the next letter that I read is actually one where he is going AWOL. Okay, Culpeper Courthouse, November 11th, 1862. Dear Rosser, I take my pen in hand to write a few lines and let you know I am well. I received your letter a few days ago and was truly glad to hear from you. I am sorry that you think I have forgotten, that I have forgot about you, but I don't blame you for saying so. I knew I ought to come to see you before now, but I could not come without. I run the block head, and I didn't like to do that. I like to act honorable if I can. If I had pretended to sick to keep out of battle and come home that day, I might been there long ago, but think myself above that. You may look for me soon. I will be there between now and Christmas soon, sometime. I may come in 2 or 3 weeks, and I may come sooner. I am certainly coming home before Christmas. I can't get any furlough, but I am coming anyhow. You will hear from me before I get there. You need not write any more, yet if you do, you must write to Gordonsville. We will be there before long. Nothing more. Yours sincerely, M.B. Thurman. So, anyway, at this point, he leaves. He goes AWOL. They get married. And after they get married, the last letter that I'll read to you is really sweet. It's a bit longer, so I'm just going to read parts of it. Jenny Station, Spotsylvania County, Virginia. My own dear wife, I embrace the opportunity this evening of writing a few lines to you to inform you that I am well at this time, and I truly hope from my heart when these few lines come to hand, they may find you enjoying all the blessings that the world can afford you. I received 2 letters from you day before yesterday. One was wrote the 20th of January. I find out now that the letters don't come straight. They are misplaced sometimes. I had just wrote one to send when I received them too, and I tore it up, and I had just written another today, and I received another. I tore that up, and I will answer them all. It makes me feel rejoicing when I get a letter from such a good friend and one that I love and esteem so highly. My dear wife, I hardly know what to write you. I love you so good. It most ruins me to think that I can't stay with you, one who I love better than anything in the whole world. I can run the blockhead and come home if I was a mine to do so, but I have not had my trial yet. If I did, it would make it hard on me. Now, I have to say, the blockhead I believe he's in the brig, and he's basically saying that he could get out of the brig and go AWOL again, but that because he hasn't even had his trial from going AWOL the first time when they got married, it probably isn't a good idea. So, and like I said, please excuse my pronunciation and grammar, but this is actually how he wrote it, and it is in the book, misspellings and all. So, okay, back to the letter. I am walking about in the camp wherever I choose. I am not guarded, and I wanted to get off clear by law if I can. Then there will be no more here after, but it is hard for me to get a discharge. I don't want to run the blockhead, but I am coming before long whether I get a discharge or no. Though I know we are all bound to be governed by the laws or be put to a great deal of trouble, but I wouldn't stray away from you and forsake you, not for all the southern states, nor I wouldn't give you for all the southern states and everything in it, because I know I never would see any more pleasure without you. My pleasure would be ruined if I did. I am glad to hear your mother is getting better. I was getting very uneasy about her. She has been like a mother to me, and she shall never suffer for anything as long as I am able to help her. That's really what he wrote. I think he probably mean is long is or is, as long as, but he wrote is long is. You must do the best you can for her and do the best you can for yourself until I come home. I will be your friend until I die. Don't direct your letters to Tom Morris no more. I thank you kindly for the letter your brother wrote to me for you, and I thank him too. He is a gentleman, every inch of him. He wrote it exactly is I wanted it wrote. I wrote a letter to your brother. I don't know what this Puritanian, I don't know what that is, so you'll have to forgive me. Yesterday, you must tell him to come down and see me. If he can come, it will be beneficial to him, if his health will admit him to do. What he's basically telling her is that she has to send letters. The letters used to go to the commanding officer. You would actually address them to the commanding officer, but he's decided he can't trust his commanding officer anymore, so he doesn't want the letter to go to Tom Morris anymore. So, anyway, and now we get back to, I will just go to his closing. I will bring my letter to a close by saying I will remain your true and loving husband until death parts us. Farewell for this time. Yours sincerely, M.B. Thurman, to his dear loving wife, Miss Jane R. Thurman, 14th Regiment of Major R.H. Poor. So, I thought those were such lovely letters, even with the misspelling and the complete and total lack of punctuation. I just thought they were beautiful. Through the entire book, you see the love between the two and the difficulty of being separated. So to all my fellow military spouses out there, I dedicate this podcast to you and to my honey, who will be spending Christmas by himself this year. I am so glad that we have email, Magic Jack, Skype, and the Postal Service. I really don't think a horse and rider would be able to get your gift to you in time. So that is our podcast for today. If you have any questions, comments, or snide remarks, all of which we accept, please contact us at historieshotties@yahoo.com. That's historieshotties@yahoo.com. And feel free to check out our Facebook page. It's just History's Hotties. And until next time.